Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with...
Alyssa Wilmuth-Keegan.
Who's playing?
Maggie the Cat.
And?
Rick Fauché. I play Big Daddy.
Yes.
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Awesome. Yes, they're here for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is at Roundhouse Theater. We're so happy to have you guys in here. This is
Thank
awesome.
You, Jason.
Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Let's just dive right in because This is Tennessee Williams, and I just discovered that you're married to who played the gentleman caller, Thomas Keegan.
Yeah, Glass Menagerie at Ford's.
So if someone came out to see Glass Menagerie at Ford's and maybe, let's say, they're just wading into this whole Tennessee Williams thing, tell them what they might expect from this, comparing it to what they saw at Glass Menagerie.
Well, I think the language is as rich as it was in Glass Menagerie. I mean, Tennessee Williams is amazing with language. And so I think that the pace is, I think, complementary to that show. I think the struggle of the sense of identity and needing to break free of whatever circumstance you're in currently is a big theme for him. So I think that those... go hand in hand. I think that'll be similar. I don't know, Rick. Did you see Glass, didn't you?
I did not see the Glass at Ford's. I've seen Glass, and of course, it's one of the plays that we get early on in our English literature in school, and it has always been and remains my favorite play.
Tennessee Williams.
If ever I'm asked a pedestrian question, what's your favorite play? That one always pops to mind.
Why is it?
I think because of as Alyssa was saying, Tennessee's ability to turn the everyday into something so heartrendingly poetic. And yet you're sitting there watching it or reading it or listening to it, and you say, this is so beautiful, and yet it still sounds like it's coming out of the mouths of regular people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get it sometimes. I just don't get. You know, it's the same with Shakespeare. You listen to the majesty of that language, and of course Shakespeare's language is heightened because he's writing in an archaic form. But with Tennessee, the poetry just jumps off the page, and when you're putting a play on, when you're actually speaking these words, you begin to realize just how magisterial his talent was.
And I have to say, I think that with Glass and with this current production that we're working on right now, from my perspective, it's been a real delight to watch such seasoned actors use that language.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a strange fine line of the everyday meets the extraordinary, and they blend seamlessly together, particularly when you have really, really good actors manipulating those words. And I mean, I just get to sit back and watch Act Two in rehearsals between Rick and Gregory Waddell, who's playing Brick, and it's just awesome to watch.
Yeah. Tell me about Gregory. What's it like working with him?
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
He really is, and he's not bad on the eyes, so that helps. he's incredibly seasoned in his own right. I mean, he's got an extensive resume, and but he's lovely to work with, and I think for such a complex relationship, and such a complex character that doesn't say nearly as much as the people around him, he's done a really nice job at developing a whole internal dialogue. So he's even, you know, speaking when he's not literally speaking, and I think that can be the pitfall of the character of Brick, is that they kind of, I'm drinking, I'm going to shut down, I'm not listening, and he keeps saying all of these things, but he actually has to stay engaged, or else, you know, why does the audience care? And I think he's a wonderful collaborator.
Yeah. Remind our audience, in case they haven't, you know, we said we read this stuff back in high school, but maybe in case they haven't seen or read Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, you know, explain them just the general, what it's about.
Well, the scholars claim that this is... Tennessee's masterwork, but of many masterworks.
Yeah.
I mean, just say Streetcar, and everybody knows who and what you're talking about. But this did come later in his writing career, in the mid-50s. In fact, He was putting the finishing touches on his first draft in the summer of 1954, the summer that I was born. So when I read that in my history reading, I used it as something of a talisman.
So this was Menagerie was his breakthrough. Streetcar was like, I know the movie was 51, so yes. That had to be. So this was after both of these.
That's right. Mm-hmm. This occurred in the mid-50s. And he, of course, and through it all, he had a slew of other great hits. I think what he was getting at in this play was the question of identity and who are we really? And it was a question that he lived with all his life. Mm-hmm. So even though the characters in this play do not exactly mirror him and his family, as in all of his plays, I think he picked up a lot in his own life that he shows to us, as I said earlier, in this highly poetical way.
Yeah.
The relationship between Brick and Big Daddy, for instance, is at once punishing and hopeful. And we see in the dialogue that takes place between the two of them that this might have been a place where Tennessee hoped his father might have sat him down and said, I know I'm a bastard, but I'm going to give you the opportunity to talk. So, I'm not sure Tennessee ever got that, but maybe in his heart of hearts, he really, really wanted it.
So this is sort of a creative guy, an artist, working out his own, you know, his life, what he'd hoped maybe from his own father-son relationship.
I think you're absolutely right, Jason. Yeah. He wasn't able to separate his artistic self from his real self.
Like all the great ones, really. I mean, that's what you write what you know, right?
Like you.
Well, I don't know about that. awesome. So I'm more obviously I'm like a huge movie buff. So it who was it? It was Burl Ives, maybe?
Yes,
yeah,
that's
okay,
right.
Okay. When and then yours is a Liz Taylor role, and then obviously Paul Newman is
yes.
a great flick. But so yeah, I mean, when did you guys both become aware of when did you see that version and how does this differ?
I actually had never watched the movie until like a few years ago. And I think that it's a lot different than the play. And I know Tennessee was really upset by that because there is this idea and this struggle with homosexuality that plays a very large part of the play. And in the movie, it's almost entirely absent. And so the conflict between Brick and Maggie and, you know, his dead friend Skipper, like, you don't know why there's that conflict so much in the movie.
You think it was 50s Hollywood just wasn't ready to go there? If it was made today, maybe they would have gone
there?
Oh, I
think if it was made today, they would absolutely honor the play. But the other thing is that this play has had lots of iterations, you know, the one that was even on Broadway, the Elia Kazan one, he really encouraged Tennessee to rewrite Act Three and make it lighter. It was very, very dark, and Big Daddy never came in at the end, and it was
Kazan wanted to make it lighter.
Yeah, because he just wanted it palatable for an audience. He wanted people to leave and at least have an idea that potentially there could be some happiness at the end of the play. And Williams was much more interested in it being real. And a lot of times things don't even have an echo of working out.
Right.
You know, and so he was, I think, really keen on that, but it wasn't something that would sell well. And he, you know, came to terms with that with the Broadway production and I think found a sense of peace about it and later enjoyed it. But you know, he rewrote portions of it again in 1974 when he did a production with Michael Kahn. He rewrote some of it. So there's several different published versions of this play.
Famous takes on it,
Yeah.
The poor writer comes up against a lot of struggles, hurdles, and blows in his fight with the marketplace. There are things, I think, that were inside of Tennessee that he wanted to write that the marketplace at that time just wouldn't bear. And even in 1974, when he was updating it, I use that word in air quotes, there were still some things that he had to that he had to tiptoe around. Those were the days when we were just beginning to break open the boundaries of what we could talk about as a civilized and a caring society.
Yeah, and I guess you had to be a little more subversive back then to get that out. Well, so how? What's the freedom of this production? I mean, we're in 2016, Roundhouse Theater. You guys can go there. You can go there in this
one. Oh, man, absolutely. And let me tell you, Jason, there's nothing like getting hold of a part that has some meaning for the writer. And then that is transferred to a director like Mitchell Hebert, who moves it on to us. It really is the ultimate triumvirate of writer, director, actor working together. And nothing, I think, I don't know if Alyssa will agree with this, I would imagine probably so, nothing can be more rewarding for an actor than to have those three elements working on all pistons.
Absolutely. Awesome.
Tell me about the director, Mitchell. Have either of you worked with him before? Or is this first time?
Yes, I've worked with Mitchell for many years as an actor. I've done scenes with Mitchell, and we've done plays together. He's a fabulous actor, and Mitchell directed me in Glengarry Glen Ross at Roundhouse Theater in 2013.
He won the Helen Hayes for Best Director for that, didn't he?
That's right.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
Should have offered you coffee.
He's really an actor's director because he is himself at heart an actor. Mm. And it's wonderful to work for somebody like that who really gets it, who gets what you're going through, who gets, even when he's trying to give you a note that he thinks you might agree with or disagree with, he'll say, look, I know what this must sound like to you because he is himself an actor. The other great thing is that when we take a break, like all actors want to do, he makes the breaks much longer than they should be.
Yeah. He gives some nice wiggle room.
That's awesome. Well, in that spirit, take a couple seconds break. Okay, Brett. So now, have you ever played it before, this part?
No. Nope.
Either of you? Nope. This is the first time? Okay.
First time.
So what was most, let's say... What surprised you the most about once you started digging down into that character? What did you sort of expect from being aware of it and then, you know, discover?
I think initially I was a little overwhelmed with this idea that people have preconceived notions about what this character should be. They think of Elizabeth Taylor and so, attempting to hit all of those things and make everybody happy, consumed me for a short period of time. And then I realized that that was a fool's errand and it's completely impossible to do that.
Exactly.
I think that what I had thought about her initially was that she's just this iconic sex symbol. And she is that. Translated through me, what I had realized, which I did not know, is that she's hilarious. She's really fun. She's really funny. And I had read it, but until I had started like really inhabiting it in rehearsals, I didn't know what a ham she was. Mm-hmm. And so she's not just sexy and sexual because she's physically attractive. She's a cut up. Mm-hmm. You know, she's somebody that people want to be around because she just commands a room. You know, she's the master of revels.
Isn't it funny how on the page you can read those words, but it's not until you inhabit it and you know, run the room, like you're saying, that you actually can see that and jump off? That's crazy how that works.
And she's got a lot of, like, I mean, she's like jazz. Like she's all over the place. She's slow. She's fast. She's complicated. She's simple. Like it kind of runs the gamut. She goes all over the place.
And maybe that's the New Orleans coming out, the Tennessee Williams thing. She's like jazz. There you go. I literally just got back from New Orleans yesterday. So,
awesome.
So this is perfect. I rode right by a Tennessee Williams house. So this
is that right?
The stars are all aligning here, guys.
Nice.
Well, I grew up down there.
Really?
I grew up in the Bayou country and, to be able to embrace this character of Big Daddy brings back all kinds of memories of guys I saw coming into my dad's barber shop. My dad was a barber for many, many years, and I would sit there as a little boy and just listen to these old rascals come in and just wax eloquent all day long about the simplest of things so that they would take this tiniest thing and make it seem huge and make it seem like the most important thing in the world. And it was all because of their bombast and their take on life. And that's what you get when you play one of these characters. Mm-hmm. They're just plain full of life.
Yeah. So you bring some of that Bayou upbringing into this role?
Oh, there's one specific guy that I can remember sitting in my daddy's barber chair every day getting his hair cut every week. And
there was a big daddy?
There's some of him on that stage there at the Roundhouse Theater.
Minus the haircut.
Minus the haircut.
If you're sitting in the front row, you're not going to get clippings everywhere. It's okay. How about what I asked her, though? What did you sort of discover about Big Daddy that maybe surprised you or, you know, pleasantly or maybe shockingly?
Well, you're absolutely right, Jason, in that when you do one of these plays, you get to study it a lot closer than you would just on a reading or on a single viewing. And to go deep into the story of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and to understand where Big Daddy is coming from in the central act of the play, having this feeling of new birth. He's just gotten great news from the clinic that he is not, in fact, dying of cancer, mm-hmm. but only has a spastic colon. And at 65, this is all he needs to put him back in the driver's seat, and he's going to change his life. And the way he's going to change his life is to embrace it more fully and more raucously and in much more of a body fashion. He's mm-hmm. going to get out there and do it. And
from the barber chair to the driver's seat, man.
That's right. It's a different world for him. And, of course, that all comes crashing down. Right. But it's remarkable to get inside the head of someone who, on stage, in front of the audience, makes such a drastic change.
Yeah. Were you aware, because I think a few minutes ago you said that Tennessee Williams later added the later scene with Big Daddy in there? Mm-hmm.
He adjusted Act 3.
He adjusted it.
Right.
Because you said that scene wasn't in there originally.
His original Act 3 was very dark and tragic, as it is now. But Big Daddy did not appear in Act 3.
So what's your take on that Act 3? Do you think it, since you were in that role?
I agree with Elia Kazan. Elia Kazan sort of encouraged forced him to put Big Daddy back into Act 3 because he said a character that important, you know, it may be artistically pleasing to you, Tennessee, but the audience demands to know what happens. They demand to see this character again. Yeah. And Big Daddy's appearance in Act 3 is not long, and it's not the aria that Act 2 is, but he does come back, and we at least get to see him one more time. And I agree with that.
Does that speak to, either of you can answer this, but does that sort of speak to, you know, the collaborative process that theater and film and everything else is that, you know, you can have someone as brilliant as Tennessee Williams who, you know, of all people should be able to have that carte blanche thing, but even him, you know, maybe it's improved by having a Kazan and, you know, to be able to listen to your collaborators.
And Williams-Kazan was one of the hallmark collaborations of the theater.
Yeah. Because
stuff together, and Tennessee wrote about this, just that he would have been nothing without Elia Kazan.
Why is it important that, you know, let's say a director or playwright or even an actress, you know, be, I guess, open-minded in that way to sculpt it beyond what they originally thought it was going to be?
Well, I think that as humans, we can be limited in our scope. We know what we know, and even the most brilliant people tend to stay in their grooved lines.
Their lane.
Yeah, their lane. And when you have people that you collaborate with that you can trust, I think that that's, you know, where it can get dicey is when you're trying to collaborate with somebody that you don't trust. I think that sometimes that communication could get broken down. But in this case, there is nothing that anyone, like cast, director, designers, could suggest to me that I'd be like, oh my gosh, great, I'm totally going to try that. Because I just feel like across the board, just like what Rick said, everyone involved in this production is so competent. Mm-hmm. And for me, particularly with Mitch, he, you know, he has us do these wackadoo things. Like one day we were running out.
Like coming to WTOP. I mean, that's the most wackadoo thing you could do.
Well, he had us do act one as if we were in a Noel Coward play. So suddenly we had these like really ridiculous British accents, and it was very fast, and it was like we were opening, closing things, and it right. was like, ha, 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 you know. And it was absolutely ridiculous, but sometimes doing the most ridiculous version of what you're working on right. breaks open
right.
some things that you didn't even know.
Unlocks other pieces that you might not have discovered.
Yeah, and yeah. even if you find, like, one golden nugget amidst all of this ridiculous chaos, right. you would have never found that brilliant moment mm. without doing something like that. And
so it was worth it.
Absolutely worth
and,
it.
And everybody was game for it.
Yeah.
There's a great... Congress of thought among the acting and theater community here in Washington. We're very lucky to have a very collegial scene here.
So
and you you end up working with people you've worked with before again and again, and you develop a shorthand, and you develop, you know, guys that you've played with before, and you know where they're going, and you can understand where they're coming from. It's a real blessing.
Absolutely. Tell me into, because you're talking about all the different, you know, if a wardrobe person could suggest something, whatever. Take me into the, you know, the staging of it. Is it like a minimal set? What's the presentation like?
Mitch calls the play operatic realism. Okay. And I think the set really follows that. The downstage playing area is perfectly realistic, and you feel like you're in the faded drawing room of an old plantation mansion, but it's surrounded by these towering shutters that open at various stages and go up into the netherworld, and I think makes you understand that we're here on Earth, but we're constantly searching and reaching for something up in the sky.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful set. Yeah. Megan Raham is the scenic designer for the show, and it is just, it's an extraordinary thing to be able to play on, and I think that it does kind of inhabit the reality and the
transcendence.
The transcendence, yeah. yeah, exactly.
And isn't that what the theater is supposed to do? You get things in the theater you're never going to get in the movies, you know? Not to poo-poo the movies, but just to say it's a different art form.
Yeah.
It really is.
Tell me how sort of that, you know, you just described how the set and the shutters and it's them reaching upward, you know.
Yes.
Tell me how that sort of worked subconsciously on the audience. You know, they're listening to the words and taking in the plot and all that, but in the meantime, all these other artists are working wonders on their subconscious
well,
with
I
the design.
Well, I would ask those who are listening to us today to answer your question.
Anyone who's
been sitting in the theater knows that, yes, there is a theatrical magic that's very difficult to define and describe, but doggone it, you really know it when you feel it.
Yeah. Tell me, I want to know a little more about both of you guys and how you came to where you are as actors. So you grew up... you said down south.
I grew up way down south, down in a town called Houma, Louisiana, and was in the radio and TV business for some years. That took me out of the south, and I traveled around doing that a little bit. Came here in 1982 to do broadcasting and quickly made the shift. I had studied theater in college, and it's what was in my heart. Mm. And I landed here, and through a series of events, found myself in search of work. And does that ring a bell with you at all, Jason?
Right.
Yes, sure.
We've all been there, right?
And ended up back on stage and never looked back. And that's been 33 years ago now.
Awesome.
So I've been very fortunate. This has been a great place to do it.
Yeah.
It really has.
Absolutely. And you, Alyssa?
I'm a good Midwestern girl.
Born and raised?
Born in Michigan. And I don't think I'm trying to think back, but I don't think I'd ever even been to DC until I moved here in 2010. And I came here for, the Academy for Classical Acting MFA program through the Shakespeare Theater Company and George Washington University. And I didn't know about the DC theater scene until I came here. It's
you were taken aback at how,
I was really surprised at not only the quality and the amount of theater that was being done here, but the real community. Like, people set down roots here. I mean, I've only been here for, you know, going on 6 years, but I've been working with people who have been working in the scene for 20, 30 years, and everyone has this history with each other. And they're like, oh, yeah, back when the theater was, you know, in a warehouse somewhere, and now it's this, you know, grand, you know, like, it's just, it's really an exceptional thing to find this pocket. And I think I spend a lot of time in New York, and I have a lot of friends that, you know, went to Chicago and stuff after school. But I mean, this is just a really, really special, special place. And my husband and I feel so immensely fortunate to have found it, because we only work as actors. I mean, we do other things besides theater. Right. We do voiceover and commercial TV stuff. But that's all available to us.
You might not be able to do that in other towns. You know,
absolutely. Yeah. And we have a toddler, you know, so we're able to, you know, have a family. And, you know, Rick has children. I mean, like, and Mitch does. Like, so many people, actors in this town, have settled, have roots, have family here. And the community welcomes that and wants that. And I think that that's really unusual.
Well, Tennessee Williams, I saw this quote while I was down there. Side note, I saw the reason I went down there is my cousin is the center fielder for LSU in baseball. So he's probably going to get drafted next year. So anyway, we went down to watch Baton Rouge and watch him play Baton Rouge.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They're great year in, year out. But we swung down to New Orleans and I saw a quote where, and this gets back to what you were saying about the D.C. and the cities, but he said that there's only three cities in America, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans, and everything else is just Cleveland. Why is D.C. not just Cleveland? Why you just proved the point. Washington is this, you know, hub of creativity. It really is.
Well, Cleveland's a great town, but I think in this day and time, all the American cities are really claiming their own personality. That's one of the great things about the urban scene.
Yeah,
definitely.
Jason, will you allow us an opportunity to shout out to Sarah Marshall and Todd Schofield?
You can shout out to whoever you would like to shout out.
Barney Penny.
All these terrific people. Todd Schofield and I did the two-hander Freud's Last Session at Theater J a couple of years ago, and he plays Gooper in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and it is such a thrill to be back on stage. He really personifies that description I was giving to Greg a moment ago about just looking into his eyes and knowing where he's going and what he's thinking. Sarah Marshall and I have been playing together for almost 30 years, and in some ways, she plays Big Mama. In some ways, I feel married to Sarah. and some of the shouting back and forth we do to each other comes off the tongue quite naturally. Marnie Penning has been in town for many, many years, took a break to get her family started, and is now back on stage. And
she's wonderful.
It'll be a thrill to see her back up there.
I mean, she's extraordinary. And this is the first time I've worked with any of these people. So I've seen a lot of them on stage previously, and was, you know, really gobsmacked when I found out that I was going to be able to work with all of them. So it's really wonderful. And then, of course, we also have Tom Truss and Steve Martin playing respectively Reverend Tucker.
The preacher.
The preacher.
Yeah.
And Doc Baugh. And they're fantastic, too. I mean, everybody really, no matter what role they're playing, they really inhabit and create a full world already. And, you know, we're about to go into tech, which I can't believe, but I really feel like everybody's got a nice handle independently of who they want their character to be, and it's really meshing well with everyone else. Everybody's playing really well together.
Mitch is great at casting, and Roundhouse, for some reason, always manages to attract top talent in town. It's really a joy to be part of this project.
Yeah, sounds like a good little group we got here.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Do you know about Roundhouse's Play It Forward?
Play It Forward, no.
High school student can get a free ticket to Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or any show at Roundhouse.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No. And then the hopes that they will one day play it forward as well.
Well, yeah, we gotta attract that new audience. It's gotta, you know.
It's awesome.
Unbelievable offer. This is the only theater. It may not be the only theater in town doing this, but it's the only one that I've heard of that's doing this and in such an extensive way. Any high school student to be able to come to the box office and get a free ticket to any show season, like, and tickets for every show. They can see, for free the entire season. And that's.
Give me the particulars on that. They have to show up with, I guess in high school you don't have IDs, do you? But, it's like a college ID. But how do you, let's say someone hears this and they say, oh, my high school would love to. How do you bring?
You just call and reserve your ticket. I imagine they might want to see your school ID or something when you show up at the box office. But maybe not.
I'm a 40-year-old junior.
Yeah, I can't imagine they'd give you too much trouble. But all the theaters in town do a great job on outreach and trying to involve young people. After all, we need to replenish the audience. We just need to keep the audience coming to theater. As a young person, someone can sit there and say, wow, this is a different experience than watching TV or going to the movies,
awesome.
We've got to make sure that theater does not die.
I'll definitely have to. I'll play up that part in the piece, play it forward, because that's amazing. That's a really great idea.
Isn't that something?
I like it a lot.
All you have to do.
Why doesn't everyone do that?
All you have to do is be a high school student.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, what power.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, let's say some high schooler or their parent are stuck in traffic listening to WTOP. They hear this, and then they say, oh, let's do this. Let's do the Play It Forward program. They go. They watch it. How might Tennessee Williams, who was writing this a half century ago, how that might speak to a high schooler now? What might they take from this?
I mean, I think it's right up their alley.
Identity?
Exactly. Identity, dealing with family drama, dealing with difficult sexuality questions. I think that it's a hot, intriguing, fraught play. And I think that absolutely echoes what, they're dealing with in their own lives.
It's the perfect thing, perfect work for Play It Forward.
Yeah.
No kidding. among the many things that you think about when you see this play is the money can't buy everything. And that's probably a pretty good message for a high school student to hear today.
Yeah. I would say, for any of us, really.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Awesome. I really appreciate you guys coming in. This was a lot of fun. Is there anything we forgot?
The show?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, what's the particulars?
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is running at Roundhouse Theater from March 30th to April 24th. And you can get tickets either by getting online and going to roundhousetheater.org, or you can call the box office at 240-644-1100 to get your tickets.
Cool. And we'll throw the link up on the website and everything as well.
Blended.
Or just be a high school student, we found out.
Yes.
That's all you got to do.
Yep.
Save yourself
That's
some
right.
time and just be in high school.
Wouldn't it be great to get an audience full of nothing but high school students?
Oof.
Might happen.
That would be kind of cool.
Audience.
That would be cool. Also, adults are welcome because it's
yes,
an awesome play.
Adults.
Yes,
right.
Everybody.
Right.
Everybody. All right, cool. Before we go, what's the final pitch? Why should they come out? Maybe they've seen it before or, read it. Why should they come anyway?
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is a play for the ages. It's one of the great masterworks of dramatic literature. And just like Hamlet, I think it's a play you can see once every 3 or 4 years. So if you've seen it recently, not to worry. Yeah. You've got another take on it with this one.
You probably should see the greats every 3 or 4 years because you notice new things each time.
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely.
First time you're watching something, you're just following what's going on.
That's the thing about sitting backstage and listening to a play while you're waiting to go on. Like even at the end of a run, you can be sitting there in the wings and hear something and say, wow, has that line been in the play this entire time?
I was too busy changing costumes.
Yes,
I missed that last
exactly.
time. Yeah, awesome. Cool. And what's your final pitch on why they should come?
I mean, I really enjoyed what Rick had to say about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that similarly to the plays like Hamlet, ones that get done over and over and over again, they change every time because the people that are involved are different. They have different life experiences. They have different energies. And so the way that we inhabit these characters will be the only way that this play will ever be done. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody else will do it a different way, but right. we're going to do it with Rick's energy as Big right. Daddy, my energy as Maggie the Cat, and everyone coming into this is so dedicated and interesting as people themselves that that it will be fresh because it will be us.
Every show is a one-off, really. Yeah. It's you're in there locked in a room together, and that you're all experiencing that magic together. It's yeah. awesome.
You seem to know a lot about the theater, Jason. Do you ever act yourself?
I haven't. I write and direct some scripts every now and then, but I've never actually acted. I would mm-hmm. love the chance. It'd be fun to do a class or something.
Allow the bug to bite. My guess is that it would really take.
You think so?
Yeah.
yeah.
All right.
Give me your headshot and resume. I'll pass it along to the people at Roundhouse Theater.
All right. We'll see what we can do. All right. Guys, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks,
well
Jason.
Done, Jason. Thank awesome. You very much.